Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Five women vying against each other.
Mountaineers who put everything on the line to follow their dreams.
To be the first to climb all 8,000 metre peaks.
The 14 highest mountains.
Amazing sports stories from the BBC World Service presents Chasing Mountains.
Every step was an achievement.
Listen now by searching for Amazing Sports Stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Janet Jalil, and in the early hours of Wednesday, the 8th of May, these are our main stories. Stormy Daniels, the porn star at the centre of Donald Trump's criminal trial, tells the court about their alleged sexual encounter. Israel has said it will continue its attack on Rafah in southern Gaza until Hamas is defeated or the first of the remaining hostages is released. TikTok is suing the US government over its move to ban the app if its Chinese owners don't agree to sell it. Also in this podcast, one of the biggest music events of the year has kicked off in Sweden with the first Eurovision Song Contest semi-final. Donald Trump's hush money trial has been hearing evidence from the porn star at the centre of the case in one of the most riveting days of testimony. Sitting just metres from Mr. Trump in a New York courtroom, Stormy Daniels described the sexual encounter she says they had, sometimes in graphic detail. He denies any such encounter occurred and has pleaded not guilty to falsifying business records to conceal a payment of $130,000 to buy the porn star's silence ahead of the 2016 presidential election. Our North America editor, Sarah Smith, sent this report from outside the court.
This is the moment much of the world's media has been waiting for. Stormy Daniels in the witness box. The US networks are very excited.
And with that, we do want to switch to some breaking news out of New York right now. The attorney for porn star Stormy Daniels says she herself is expected to appear as a witness in the Trump hush money fraud trial today.
The details that are being described in front of this jury are quite explicit. Having Stormy Daniels say that she took a rolled-up magazine and spanked Donald Trump in the butt.
Stormy Daniels was paid $130,000 by Donald Trump to keep quiet. And now she's telling her story in court, including her claim, vehemently denied by Mr. Trump, that they had a sexual encounter.
Mr. Trump, is this true?
The former president ignored reporters' questions as he moved around the courthouse. She arrived in court modestly dressed, in a long black dress and wearing glasses. Mr. Trump was watching, his expression at times uninterested, at times annoyed, as she described her career, and he seemed to look down when she was asked to identify him in court. A photo of the two of them together was shown to the court, taken when they first met at a golf tournament in 2006. Ms. Daniels described how a bodyguard invited her to have dinner with Mr. Trump, and she said when she got to his hotel suite, she made fun of him for wearing black silk pyjamas. When the prosecution asked Ms. Daniels about having sex with Mr. Trump, she was frequently interrupted by objections from his lawyers. Did you, at some point, end up on the bed having sex with him, she was asked. Yes, replied Stormy Daniels, going into some detail. The judge appeared unhappy about the length of her answers and the level of detail, telling her to just answer the questions, while Donald Trump seemed to be fidgeting restlessly as he listened. Earlier, Mr. Trump posted on social media, I've just recently been told who the witness is today. This is unprecedented. No time for lawyers to prepare. He then quickly deleted it. He's already been warned by the judge. He could be jailed if he continues to post about witnesses in this trial.
Sarah Smith. Let's turn now to events in the Middle East. For more than a million Palestinians fleeing the war in Gaza, the southernmost city of Rafah has become their last refuge. Now Israel has threatened to expand its military operation in Rafah after its troops seized the main border crossing between Gaza and Egypt. Israel defied months of international pressure to launch a ground offensive in Rafah on Monday, hours after Hamas said it had accepted a proposal for a ceasefire deal. The Israeli Prime Minister rejected this, but at the same time dispatched a team of negotiators to Cairo to continue talks. With the Rafah crossing and another one at Kerem Shalom closed, aid agencies now say it's nearly impossible to bring in supplies for Palestinian civilians. The UN Secretary General, Antonio Guterres, urged Israel to reopen both crossings and warned that a full-scale assault on Rafah would be a disaster.
After more than 1,100 Israelis killed in the Hamas terror attacks of 7 October, after more than 34,000 Palestinians killed in Gaza, haven't we seen enough? Haven't civilians suffered enough death and destruction? Make no mistake, a full-scale assault on Rafah would be a human catastrophe.
But Israel says it will continue its attack on Rafah until Hamas is defeated or the first of its remaining hostages is released. David Mensah, a spokesman for the Israeli government, explained why it's not allowing humanitarian workers access to the Rafah crossing.
Our intelligence has clearly shown that the Rafah crossing in particular with Egypt in eastern Rafah has been used for terrorist purposes. Our troops have now obtained operational control of the Gazan side of the crossing. Now, underneath that large border infrastructure are cross-border underground smuggling tunnels, sustaining and providing a lifeline to Hamas. These Hamas tunnels must be dealt with.
After Israel's order to evacuate parts of eastern Rafah, tens of thousands of people have been wearily packing up whatever possessions they can carry as Israel carries out attacks it says are aimed at eliminating Hamas fighters. Rada Al-Haddad works for the aid organisation Oxfam in Gaza.
We are tired and exhausted because we don't know where to go. All the places have been hit. There are ongoing airstrikes and non-stop artillery shellings everywhere in Gaza. So the pressing question in everyone's mind is, where do we go? Where to find a safer place for ourselves, for our children and for our family members?
I asked Frank Gardner in Jerusalem how long he thought the two border crossings into Gaza would remain closed.
Well, everyone's hoping that it's a temporary closure, and it's absolutely the last thing that Gazans and aid agencies need, because these are the two main arteries for getting aid into the territory. There are other crossing points, but these are the main ones. The blame for this falls on both Israel and Hamas. A few days ago, Hamas carried out a deadly rocket strike on the Israeli side of the Kerem Shalom crossing point. Now, that's the main cargo crossing point right down at the bottom southeast corner of the Gaza Strip. And it had been shut. The US, Britain and other countries had pressured Israel to open it almost as soon as it was open. And only a few days ago, Antony Blinken, the US Secretary of State, was down there to visit it. They rocketed it. So Israel shut it. Since then, Israel has warned around 100,000 Gazan residents, not really residents, they're displaced people who've already been moved from their homes in north of the Gaza Strip, to evacuate eastern Rafah to areas that they say are safe or safer, but which aid agencies say are completely unsuitable for them. It's really grim for that population. With them evacuated, Israel has been pushing tanks, infantry and artillery and carrying out airstrikes in the eastern Rafah area of the border. It's stopping just short of it being a major military operation, which the US has said it would veto. But nevertheless, it is a military operation. People are being killed. Israel says it's finding tunnels and killing fighters, and it's raised its flag on the Palestinian side of the Rafah border. There is some discussion about whether the removal of a Palestinian checkpoint on the Gazan side of the border will now be permanent, that there's going to be some kind of possibly even a private security company taking over the management of that checkpoint.
Right. And we know that Israel is sending a delegation to Cairo, not a high-level delegation, despite the fact that the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says the Hamas ceasefire proposal falls well short. Do we know what Israel is unhappy about?
We do. It's about a ceasefire. Is it going to be permanent? Hamas do not want to sign up to a deal that doesn't include a full and final ceasefire. Then they don't want to hand over their prime bargaining chip, which are the hostages, to Israel. And then the very next day, once they've handed the last one over, they undergo a massive military assault that wipes them out. Leaving aside the fact that they are a proscribed terrorist organization by many countries, that makes no sense to them. Right. Israel's view is they're not going to sign up to a deal that leaves Hamas intact.
Frank Gardner, the hugely popular social media platform TikTok and its Chinese parent company ByteDance have filed a lawsuit against the US government. They're challenging a law that would force a sale or a ban of the app. Our North America correspondent Gary O'Donoghue says it has a vast number of users, both in the United States and across the world.
Well, in terms of the US, 170 million users, and the US population now is around the 340 million mark. So about half of people in the United States have it on their devices. It skews to the younger generation. It skews to women in particular. But it's a huge thing here. And of course, that's reflected worldwide. It's in 130 countries, multiple languages, about a billion users around the planet.
But the Biden administration also thinks it's a national security threat.
Yeah, in fact, it's not just the Biden administration, but kind of across one of those issues which seems to have gone across the political divide. Unusually for this country at the moment, there's sort of bipartisan support for this idea that not only is TikTok a potential threat to national security, but the data of US citizens, people believe, politicians believe, is at risk because of its Chinese ownership and the nature of the CCP's control over businesses in China, even privately owned businesses like ByteDance, which is its parent company. Also, I think there's some concerns about the influence it might have in an election year we're in. Over the last few years, TikTok's sort of content has broadened significantly, so no longer are people just watching funny dancing videos on it. They're looking for their news on it too.
But ByteDance, the parent company, is now fighting back, and it could argue that it's being singled out because it is Chinese owned, whereas other social media platforms that have also raised similar concerns are not being punished by the US administration.
Yeah, and I think the administration and Congress have been pretty clear that it's because it's Chinese owned that there is a concern. And yes, their argument focuses particularly on some of the constitutional elements. They say that this is a huge breach of the First Amendment, the Free Speech Amendment in the American Constitution. And they have had some success in other lower courts elsewhere around the country with sort of local attempts to ban them in making that argument. And it is a very powerful argument. It's difficult to explain to people around the world how the First Amendment, the Free Speech Amendment, is very, very dear to the courts in America. And so I think this is something that will maybe start in the courts of the District of Columbia where they've lodged this case, but it could easily end up in the Supreme Court at some point in the future.
Gary O'Donoghue. Britain has warned about the dangers posed by cyber attacks from hostile states. The British Defence Minister, Grant Shapps, addressed Parliament about a hack of the armed forces payroll system. While he didn't identify a specific culprit, the BBC understands the government suspects China of being behind the data breach. With more, here's our security correspondent, Gordon Carrera.
Members of the armed forces, including reservists and some veterans, received an email warning them their personal data may have been compromised. This includes names and bank details, and in some cases addresses. Up to 272,000 people could be affected, although it's not yet clear what information the cyber thieves have taken. The breach came as the result of a hack into the systems of a contractor which provides payment services and whose security is now being investigated. The Ministry of Defence said it was confident that salaries would be paid, although there were delays in paying expenses. It can take the intelligence services weeks, months, even years to formally attribute a cyber attack and blame a particular country or group. In a statement to Parliament, the Defence Secretary, Grant Shapps, was careful about apportioning blame.
For reasons of national security, we can't release further details of the suspected cyber activity behind this incident. However, I can confirm to the House that we do have indications that this was the suspected work of a malign actor, and we cannot rule out state involvement.
In this case, suspicions centre on China, partly based on a track record of similar activity. A Chinese foreign ministry spokesman described claims China was involved as absurd and a smear and said it opposed all forms of cyber attacks. It may take time to be confident who was responsible, and that will do little to help those in the armed forces worried about what's happened to their data.
Gordon Carrera. Still to come.
First developed in 1891, Carl Elsner's Swiss Army knife with an extra blade and a corkscrew was a game changer.
Now the company that makes the famous item is developing its first bladeless model. We'll tell you why.
Voiko vanhemmuuteen valmistautua? Mikä vauvakuplassa on totta ja mikä ei? Liberon odotushuone-podcastissa tehdään todellinen syväsukellus vanhemmuuden tiekarttaan. Minä olen Marja Hintikka ja tämä vanhemmuuden odotushuoneen ovi on aina auki, just sulle.
The plane started to shake a little bit, something that alerted us that there was something not right.
Remarkable personal stories told by the people that lived them.
Deep down inside you, you do have courage. You mightn't feel you've got courage. You mightn't feel that you're brave or resilient, but it's there waiting, just waiting to help you get through bad times.
Lives Less Ordinary from the BBC World Service. Find it wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Welcome back to the Global News Podcast. Rescuers in South Africa are racing against time to find more than 40 people who are missing after a five-story apartment building collapsed on Monday. At least seven people are confirmed to have died. Rescuers in the southern coastal city of George managed to find some people, but were trying to reach 11 survivors they could hear in the ruins, including four trapped in the basement. The building was still under construction when it collapsed. Emergency workers are taking it in turns to work on the site, removing concrete blocks and debris by hand. James Reynolds spoke to Maria Ferreira from the Gift of the Giver Disaster Relief Group at the site with his rescue sniffer dogs. He described the scene.
What I see around me is enormous amount of emergency vehicles, construction equipment, cranes, people, basically rescue workers. There's medical teams on site, doctors. There's people that's basically standing in the distance with the hope of a family member getting taken alive out from the concrete jungle, and it looks like a dump site of concrete with the scaffolding intertwined basically through it.
Tell us about the rescue work you're doing, please.
Well, we've got three sniffer dogs on site. We've basically are supplying some essential needs for the rescue workers, the family members of the people that is captured. That's from blankets to food items to equipment to be used with the rescue service. We're coordinating with the communities of the area, which is also coming forward very much to assist. So, yeah, we basically, where the need arrives, we're there to try and fill that need. And so far, we 8 people on site from our team, plus the 3 dogs. We've got soup kitchens going over here on site. We've got soup kitchens going in town where people are preparing meals on a constant basis just to have hot meals for the guys.
Tell us about the skills, the abilities of the sniffer dogs and how important they are for you.
If you imagine a five-story building basically collapsing, it's 5 floors down on top of each other, is been over 75 construction workers basically within the building when this happened. The sniffer dogs basically, I mean, if you look at this pile of rubble that lies here, you can't hear people, you can't see people. So it's essential that we make use of that senses of that dog, that trained sniffer dogs to actually pick it up. And so far, it's been spot on every time. And a lot of people has been saved and removed from the rubble.
And when you look at the wreckage, do you have a professional assessment as to the possibility of finding survivors inside?
Well, if you look at the wreckage, no, you think it's impossible. But, I mean, there's always hope, and we're not going to give up hope. The main thing at this stage is to do the rescue mission as quickly and sufficiently with as little as possible disturbance to the wreckage of the building while taking out the people or searching for the people.
The UN's Migration Agency says it's ready to help dozens of migrants who were rescued in Libya after being held captive in a house in the southeast of the country. On Monday, the authorities in the Libyan city of Benghazi said more than 100 migrants had been found when the hideout was raided. Some of them are reported to be in very poor health. Will Ross reports.
Libya's Criminal Investigations Department has been trying to catch the head of a human trafficking gang in the southeastern town of Al-Kufra for some time. There are reports that several raids only found empty buildings as the migrants were being moved from house to house. But now a CID spokesman says 107 people from different African countries have been rescued from a house. They'd been held for several months. There are reports that some of the migrants showed signs of having been tortured. Libyan trafficking gangs often inflict appalling abuses on those they hold whilst trying to extort money from their families back home.
Will Ross. Meanwhile, far-right parties across the European Union are hoping to capitalise on concerns about immigration and the cost of living to make big gains in next month's European Parliament elections. On the back of those elections, far-right leaders in countries like France and Spain are hoping to emulate the Italian Prime Minister, Giorgia Meloni, in winning the leadership of their countries. Our correspondent, Mark Lowen, went to Latina, just south of Rome, to look at what's worrying voters there.
Well, these beasts are perhaps even harder to read than the Italian electorate. I'm beside some of the 1,800 buffaloes here at Circe, a farm an hour and a half south of Rome near Latina that produces buffalo cheese, mozzarella and ricotta. They're incredibly curious beasts. They're all peering out. It's a typical Italian business run by the same family for generations. Luigi Benedetti is co-owner.
Globalization is a challenge because we have products coming from other countries outside Europe, and those products are less expensive to make, and so this creates a problem on the market.
Can you find Italians for your workforce easily?
It's not that easy to find workers because the medium salary in Italy is not growing up from a long time. And this is very sad because many times young university students prefer to not work instead of working just because of this. Mantova.
So the farm has to turn to migrant workers to fill the gap. No shortage there, with numbers soaring at a local migrant reception centre. Unaccompanied minors here work on a puzzle of Italy, putting together the pieces of their new home, while a volunteer teaches them about the cities. 17-year-old Inusa Conate paid smugglers €2,000 to come here from Burkina Faso.
Lots of Africans think Europe is a paradise, but it's not true. When I came, I saw it wasn't as I imagined, and that I wouldn't find a job immediately. Now, I tell people back home to stay there, but I know they will keep trying. And even if Italy wants to stop the boats, it's impossible.
The smell is fantastic here in the kitchen, where the residents of this centre have been cooking all morning. So there's chicken. What else is there? Tomato?
Yeah, tomato is there, and carrot.
You used to have this back home?
Yeah. It's an African dish.
Migrant arrivals in Italy went up by 50% last year, despite the government promising to crack down, and it's another election issue. Mary Fazzolo works at the centre.
As soon as we have one place, two places, the day after we have a request for the places. It's okay for now, the numbers that we are receiving now. But I don't know in the future if they could increase more, if it would be okay. It would be a little difficult.
So you're at your maximum point, do you think?
Maybe, yes, I think so.
So this region and its capital, Latina, faces the same issues as the rest of Italy. Economic stagnation, a migrant influx, a brain drain of Italians and an ageing population. It's a long to-do list for the mayor, Matilde Celentano, the first woman in charge here, from the party of Italy's first female prime minister, Giorgia Meloni, elected 18 months ago and still topping the polls.
The Meloni government is working well. We have problems of a falling birth rate, for example, which affects all of Europe. On migration, we have taken important steps. We used to passively accept migrants, but now we have a big say in managing flows. It's important that our party wins this election so we can put forward our ideas at a European level.
Back at the buffalo farm, delicious, creamy cheese is churned out. It's an example of what this country does so well. But for all of Italy's marvellous sides, its age-old problems remain. What's changed is who's trying to solve them, with Giorgia Meloni now dominating politics, hoping to entrench her position with this election, and increasingly seen by other right-wing leaders in Europe as a figurehead, an example of what they too hope to achieve after they lock horns with rivals in the upcoming battle.
That report from Italy by Mark Lowen. One of the world's oldest men's clubs, the Garrick in London, has voted to allow women to join. The change was approved at a meeting of members on Tuesday night. The Guardian newspaper had been campaigning for women to be admitted, calling the club a bulwark of Britain's male-dominated establishment. James Shipham reports.
The Garrick was founded in 1831. Its membership list is kept secret, but it's known to include judges, MPs, journalists and senior figures from the arts, all of them men. The club has voted on previous occasions to block the admission of women. But the publication in The Guardian of the names of several dozen members had prompted calls for the Garrick to think again. Dozens are said to have threatened to resign if women were not allowed to join. Hundreds of members spent 2 hours discussing the issue. The motion to admit women is reported to have been approved by nearly 60% of those present.
James Shipham. The Swiss Army knife is the main tool of choice for scouts, usually complete with versatile options such as a screwdriver, a can opener and a pocket knife. Now the company that's been making them for more than 100 years has announced it's developing its first bladeless model. Victorinox said the change was in response to an increasing number of countries imposing tighter restrictions on carrying knives. Paul Hawkins reports.
First developed in 1891, Carl Elsner's Swiss Army knife with an extra blade and a corkscrew was a game changer. 133 years later, millions of people swear by it, including European armies, astronauts, picnickers and the scouts.
It's a backbone of one of the tools that we use when we help young people develop key skills for life.
Simon Carter is a scout leader.
If you're going to camp, you need a tin opener. Quite often you need a pair of pliers, a pair of tweezers. It's got tweezers or it's got a screwdriver on it. So a knife is one of the things that helps us, but it's not the only thing we use.
But now the company says because more and more countries are banning or restricting knives for safety reasons, it's going to be making bladeless models. At the moment, UK legislation hasn't banned carrying Swiss Army knives, but there are concerns around rising knife crime. There are now roughly 400 Swiss Army knife models, including one with 73 functions, featuring tweezers and even a USB stick. But it has always had a blade, which is why this announcement is a big deal. Victorinox is keen to stress that the original Swiss Army knife isn't being replaced by this new model, but without a blade, can they still call it a Swiss Army knife?
Paul Hawkins. The first of the Eurovision Song Contest semi-finals has been taking place in Sweden, where 15 countries have been competing for a place in the grand final on Saturday. Our arts correspondent David Litto reports from the host city, Malmö.
Hello, my name is Windows 95 Man.
This is Windows 95 Man, appearing from a large egg. He's representing Finland. Europa-papa. There's the Netherlands and Europapa. Here are the favourites. Croatia. Eurovision has arrived in Malmö. Security is a bit more visible than normal because of issues surrounding Gaza and Israel's participation in the contest. All attention is on the first semi-final. And for one country with a long and illustrious Eurovision history, something a bit different. The country that brought us double Eurovision winner Johnny Logan has in recent years a rather fallow period. The solution, Ireland hopes, is Bambi Thug, but it's a choice that raises a few eyebrows.
I don't know what happened for Ireland to suddenly put their faith in a non-binary alt witch, but I think it was a while coming.
And the reaction in Ireland, would it be fair to say mixed?
Yeah, definitely a mixed reaction. Some priests not liking me, very much.
I don't think you're too bothered by that, are you?
No.
Maybe a song contest, but fans know staging and spectacle are crucial. An idea that Ireland is definitely embracing.
That report by David Slitto. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Caroline Driscoll. The producer was Liam McSheffrey. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Janat Jalil. Until next time, goodbye.
The plane started to shake a little bit, something that alerted us that there was something not right.
Remarkable personal stories told by the people that lived them.
Deep down inside you, you do have courage. You mightn't feel you've got courage. You mightn't feel that you're brave or resilient, but it's there waiting, just waiting to help you get through bad times.
Lives Less Ordinary from the BBC World Service. Find it wherever you get your BBC podcasts.